Well, good morning. To begin with, I'm going to start with an apology. And that being, normally, my best presentations are when I feel that I know as much or more than the people I am talking to. In this case, I don't have that confidence, so just bear with me. What I'm going to be talking about is pretty much where we left off in the John study, and that is beginning pretty much with the visit to the Garden of Gethsemane. But before I move on from that, I want to kind of give an explanation for some of the sources that I'm using, some of the scriptures that I'll be reading, and that is, since this whole thing is based on the four Gospels, and the four Gospels, three of them say pretty much the same story, one of them doesn't, for the most part, for that, again, when we're only talking about the period of time on the way to Gethsemane and the trials of Jesus, okay? We're not going into the crucifixion. We're just looking at that time period. And, you know, the scriptures do vary, and not a whole lot, but there's a logical reason for it in my mind. First off, Matthew Levi was an apostle. He was there. He was there up until the time they departed on the way to Gethsemane. Luke wasn't there. Okay? Luke was an educated man. He was able to take notes and listen to the people that were there, and he eventually wrote them down. He was an active player, you know, during Paul's ministry, and he wrote Acts. Mark is rather interesting because he wasn't there until Jesus' trials began, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. And then John was there from pretty much the beginning to the end, okay, which is why John is a good one to study when we're talking about the memorial and all of that. The reason I bring all that up is that you'll find that John talks about everything except for one incident, and that being what happened at Gethsemane. Okay? And we can say that the reason that he doesn't mention anything about it outside of going to the garden is because he was ashamed of his behavior. What did he do? He was one of the three that did what? They fell asleep. Okay? They did not watch and pray while Jesus was praying. Okay? And I think that's the reason why John doesn't mention it. Okay? He talks about everything else. He has the prayer that we were just discussing in the study before. None of the others mention it. Okay? All the rest talk about Gethsemane, but he doesn't. So, we're going to begin by looking at that travel from the upper room to Gethsemane. And in Luke 22:39, he told all of his disciples, let's leave this place. And the reason he probably did that was to protect the owner of the house, because he knew they were going to be coming after him. Okay? And it's believed that the owner of that house was Mark's mother, who was a wealthy woman and also a friend of Jesus and the disciples. It's, you know, that's one of those things that historians say, okay, that's not scriptural, but I guess it's inferred in a lot of places. Now, if we look at Matthew 26, 36 through 38. Matthew 26, 36, 38. Then Jesus came to them to a place called Gethsemane and said to his disciples, sit here while I go over there and pray. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be grieved and distressed. And then he said to them, my soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch with me. Jesus was going through a whole bunch of mental pain. And the whole purpose of going to pray in the garden, okay, was to ask the Father for help, ask the Father for some kind of reassurance that how he had spent his life, okay, validated his whole purpose. Remember, he came as a ransom, a perfect man for a perfect man. If he had sinned or disappointed the Father in any way, his death would have been a waste. His life would have been a waste. It would have had absolutely no purpose. And he was afraid, okay, that perhaps he did something wrong. That's why he was really, really distressed, okay? Because here it is. The hour had come. He was waiting to die. And one of the things that not only would have happened, besides not being able to save us, or be a ransom for our sin, his life would have ended. He would have faced death if he would not have been faithful. So he had a lot on the line, okay? And he was praying really just for, Lord, help me. Help me get through this. In Luke 39 to 44, Luke 22:39-44. As soon as I find it, I'll read it. And he came out and proceeded, as was the custom, to the Mount of Olives, which was, Gethsemane was in the Mount of Olives. When he arrived at the place, he said, pray that you may not enter into temptation. And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, knelt down, and began to pray, saying, Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done. And then an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him. And being in agony, he was praying fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling upon the ground. And when he rose from prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping from sorrow. Jesus, at this time, okay, when he said, pass this cup, the cup he was talking about was, assure me, okay, this was all worthwhile, what I'm going through. He was facing a lot of mental anguish, a lot of fear. And if you can imagine, okay, going through that, he had a purpose, okay? He left sitting next to his Father, okay, to take care of mankind, to fulfill prophecies. But he wasn't sure he did it right. So, what did the Father do? Father sent an angel, okay, that did nothing else but give him confidence. Say, yeah, it's okay. You did okay. And from that moment on, Jesus took on a persona, okay, of one of confidence, one of dedication, one of just absolute resolve to follow the will of the Father. He just needed that reassurance. And I think the lesson for us in all of that, in any times of doubt or in any kind of trouble, that we do turn to prayer, okay? And we do wait for the Lord, you know, to give us that helping hand, to give us that push so we can move on. One of the things that really intrigued me about this whole study was typically when we think of the passion of Christ, we think about the physical pain, we think about the physical aspects, we think about the crowning of thorns, the smiting, the lashes, the nailing of the cross, the hanging on the cross. We don't think enough about the lessons we can learn from the mental pain that Jesus went through. We talk about wanting to become footstep followers of Jesus. Right in those few hours from the time he entered the garden, okay, up until the time they put him on the cross. Okay, he's such a wonderful example. He defended himself hardly ever. And when he did, he was doing nothing else but saying, it's my Father's will. Okay, what an example. And I think, You know, he always went to prayer. He encouraged the disciples. He reproved them when necessary. But he wasn't out of line. There's just so many examples, and one of which was, you know, part of the Gethsemane story is that the disciples fell asleep. In fact, they fell asleep three times. Okay? And after an hour, the first hour of Jesus praying, what did he do? He went out, found them asleep, and, you know, he said, hey, can't you stay awake for an hour and watch and pray? Okay? You know, it wasn't done in anger, but it was, hey, this is what we have to do, what they have to do, and that is watch and pray, because that's what he asked them to do. And then he came out a second time, and he found them asleep again. He went back and prayed some more, and he came up a third time, and they were asleep. And he basically instructed them, hey, go ahead and sleep, because what you're going to be facing is going to be extremely trying. You're going to need all the rest you can possibly get. Okay? And again, keep in mind, the apostles at that point really didn't understand what was going to happen. They heard Jesus' words, but they didn't know what it all meant and what was really going to happen. Right after that, as we read in John 18, 1 to 3, John 18, 1 to 3, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the ravine of Kidron, where there was a garden in which he entered, that's Gethsemane, entered with his disciples. Now Judas also, who was betraying him, knew the place, for Jesus had often met there with his disciples. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort and officers and from chief priests and Pharisees, came there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. According to Pastor Russell, contrary to the thought that these were Roman soldiers that had came with Judas, they were nothing else but servants of the high priest, because at this point, the Roman government was not involved. Okay? And the weapons they carried were probably just sticks. Okay? Because that was quite common for them to carry sticks to defend themselves. They didn't have large swords or anything else. But that, you know, was pretty much the common thing. Judas not only kissed Judas once, it said that he kissed him several times as a matter of greeting, as a matter of respect. And Jesus, okay, just basically said, you know, do what you have to do. You know, then they approached him, okay, and we'll go back to Matthew 26, 48 through 56, and again, we're doing jumping from gospel to gospel simply because trying to complete the entire picture of what happened. So we go to Matthew 26, 48 to 56, and while he was speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, came up, accompanied by a large group, a large crowd with swords and clubs, who came from chief priests and elders of people. Now he who was betraying him gave him a sign, saying, whomever I kiss, he is the one, seize him. And immediately Judas went to Jesus and said, hail, Rabbi, and kissed him. And Jesus said to him, friend, do what you have come for. Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those, Peter, who was with Jesus, reached and drew out his sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. And then Jesus said to Peter, put your sword back into its place, for all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot appeal to the Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? How then will the scriptures be fulfilled, which say that it must happen this way? And at that time, Jesus said to the crowd, "Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as you would a robber? Every day I used to sit in a temple, teaching, and you did not seize me. But all of those things took place to fulfill prophecies that were in the scriptures." And at that point, the disciples left him, okay, and he was alone. Now in Luke, it says that Jesus touched the ear of the slave and healed it. Okay, and again, that's the only account of that, but it seems very much like Jesus' character to do that. Also in Luke, it says that Jesus told, okay, the apostles to leave. Flee now, go. And he did that so they weren't going to be part of the persecution. Okay, and they left, and Jesus was alone, okay, to face everything else. But an interesting thing happened, and if you recall in the very beginning, I said that Mark was around, okay, for parts that no one else was around for. Okay, and if we read in Mark 14, 51 to 52, okay, Mark 14, 51, 52, "And there followed him a certain young man, having a linen cloth cast about his naked body, and the young men laid hold on him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked." It is believed that that lad was John Mark. And this gets followed up, and the reason they believe that is just like John never referred to himself by name, Mark didn't either. Mark referred to himself as the lad. But then, back in, I forgot to write this down, so you have to wait a minute. When Simon was chosen to help Jesus with the cross, Mark described Simon as being the father of two people. And still can't find it. Well, it's not that important. But anyway, there was two people, and it's assumed that those two names were John Mark's friends, okay, who happened to be the sons of Simon that helped Jesus carry the cross. Okay, just an interesting side note. But from that moment on, Mark, as a child, have no idea how old he was able to observe what Jesus went through. So, disciples were gone. Jesus was arrested. And he was brought to have his first trial, and that being the trial with Annas. Annas was a high priest from approximately 6 to 15 A.D., okay, which means he really wasn't high priest at the time of Jesus' arrest. However, according to Jewish law, once you were a high priest, you were always a high priest. So he did have some authority, and the Jewish people did look at him as the high priest. He had a lot of political ambitions. He was probably the one that Judas made the deal with. Okay, turn over Jesus and I'll give you this. Because both Annas and Caiaphas wanted Jesus out of the picture. They wanted to get rid of him. And Caiaphas was the son-in-law of Annas, so they were working in cahoots. Caiaphas was the next one to pass a judgment on Jesus. Again, he was a high priest. He was the current high priest. But Annas was the high priest before him. Okay, but the whole meeting with Annas, you know, it was unofficial. It was basically illegal that had no purpose outside of insulting Jesus and accusing him of things. Caiaphas, well, Annas took Jesus to Caiaphas. Caiaphas was the first one, then, after talking to Jesus, decided that Jesus had to die. He's the first one to pronounce that. And he's the one that called for the meeting of all of the high priests, the Sanhedrin, at his house that night, so they can get together and figure out how they can get rid of Jesus. Okay, but they knew they didn't have the authority to do that. They only had the authority, according to Jewish law, to stone Jesus. They didn't have the authority to crucify him. And they didn't want to stone him because then he would appear to everyone as a martyr. And they didn't want him to appear as a martyr. They just wanted him gone. Okay, so they figured the next step, what they had to do, was they had to present their case, okay, to the Romans. And it just so happened that Pilate, at that time, he was the governor of that region for the Roman Empire. Now, just a little bit of background in terms of how the political system worked at that time. There was actually the Roman Empire, and at that time, the emperor was Tiberius. They called the empire by itself and whole Caesar. There's a lot of scriptures that refer to Caesar, even though Caesar had been dead for quite a few years. Okay. Then we had Herod. Okay. And we had Pilate. Pilate was a governor, and the governor reported to, indirectly, to Herod. Okay, Herod was kind of the king of a region within that. So we kind of have a picture of where everything's at. But more on that as we move. When they met, when Jesus met with Caiaphas, what they tried to do was they tried to come up with some false witnesses, okay, of whatever. Again, keep in mind they wanted him gone. They wanted him dead. And they really couldn't find any good witnesses that had the same story. But eventually, through bribing, they had two witnesses, okay, that would testify against Jesus. And according to Jewish law, that's all they needed. Okay, to condemn a person, they needed two witnesses. Now, in their efforts to find these two false witnesses, they never called upon anyone that was healed, cured, anyone that would have said something on the behalf of Jesus. One of the charges that they put against him was blasphemy, and the blasphemy was basically sourced on two things that Jesus had said. One of which is he had talked about destroying the temple, and they believed that he was referring to their temple, when in fact he was talking about his own body. Okay? And when he would rebuild it in 3 days, what happened 3 days after he died? Okay? He was resurrected. Did he rebuild it? Yes. Okay? The other one of which is he said that he was the Son of God. Okay? He didn't say he was God, but that's how they pretty much interpreted it. He said, I am the Son of God. Okay? Son of man, Son of God. And that just kind of tilted the wheels. They decided that this is too much. Nobody can make that claim. Blasphemy, let's get rid of him. So what they did then is they assembled a group of the high priests, 71 of them. Okay, and this is recorded in Matthew 27, 1 and 2. And I'm going to talk faster. I only have 15 minutes left. So, but they got together with the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin, basically at 3 o'clock in the morning, okay, sat around and plotted, figured out, okay, what can we tell Pilate, okay, to make sure this man is killed? Okay? And then about 5 o'clock in the morning, they came to the conclusion, okay, and exactly at sunrise, they condemned Jesus. But they didn't have the authority. Keep that in mind. They didn't have the authority to condemn him. They had the authority to stone him, but not to crucify him. So what they did was they took him over to Pilate. Interesting thing about taking him over to Pilate is that it was against Jewish law, okay, for a Jew to enter into a Gentile's home, okay, which is where Pilate was. Okay, so the high priests were on the outside, Jesus, okay, and Pilate were on the inside. So we had this situation, it was almost like a theater. Okay, people on the outside, people on the inside. And Pilate, you know, heard all the claims. And, you know, the high priest knew that Pilate could care less if Jesus did blaspheme. So what did they do? Okay, they invented a new charge. Okay, and basically that charge was that this man said he was the king of the Jews. Okay, what did that do? Hey, now wait a minute, you're stepping on my toes. I'm the one who has authority. Are you trying to tell me you're the new king? Okay, but Pilate didn't buy into it. Okay, he basically said, I find nothing wrong with this man. But Pilate was also wise because he was the governor. And his job was to keep peace amongst the Jews. That was his primary job. It wasn't to do justice. His primary job was to keep peace. Keep the Jewish people under control. Don't bother the Roman Empire. So what he did was he turned Jesus over to Herod. Okay, and pretty much Herod, you know, he figured out the scheme. He said that, you know, hey, this is an inside issue. This is an issue over religion. This is an issue between Jesus and the Jews. This has nothing to do with anything civic. So he didn't want anything to do with the case. He didn't really pronounce Jesus innocent or guilty. But rather what he did was, here, Pilate, you deal with it. So Jesus went back again to Pilate. The Jews were so confident that Pilate would do something because simply because he had a reputation for doing something. He had a reputation for being really cruel. Okay? He also had a reputation of really not caring a whole lot about Jews. So the high priest really felt that all they had to do was make a claim, and Pilate would be more than glad to have Jesus killed. But it didn't work that way. It didn't work that way simply because through the accusations, okay, through everything, Jesus stood there, okay, with all the confidence, knowing that he was doing his Father's will. He accepted, okay, all the charges. He accepted all the insults. He accepted everything. He just stood there. And again, you know, he might have acknowledged something that they said, had you said that? He would say something to the effect, you said I did. Okay? But he never defended himself. He never stooped that low. And rather, he just stood there tough and accepted it all. Now, he did have some preparation before, because what was he praying for? Okay, he was praying for strength from the Father. And the Father gave him that strength. So he had the confidence for that. And he was able to deal with it. And finally, Pilate. What did Pilate do? Pilate said, I find nothing wrong with this man. So what he did? He said, oh yeah, I remember we have this thing that we do for the Passover. We can exchange. We can let a criminal free. So he offered up and he said to the Jews, hey, I'll give you a choice. Okay, I'll free Jesus, or I'll free this thief, Barabbas. Okay, and what did the crowd say? Okay, the crowd yelled and screamed that they wanted the thief. as opposed to Jesus. Kind of shocked, Pilate. And then Pilate, still convinced that Jesus didn't deserve to die, but he was afraid of the crowd. So then he thought, well, maybe, just maybe, if we smite him, if we beat him and really humiliate him, maybe the crowd will be happy and he won't have to die. So they went through that. But what did the crowd say? The crowd kept on yelling, crucify him, crucify him. And finally, Pilate, again, keep in mind, his job was to keep everything in order, okay, to keep things calm, to prevent problems between the Jews and the Roman Empire. He finally just said, do what you have to do, and washed his hands of the whole thing. I don't want any part of this, okay? But he did turn him over to be crucified. And then at that point, they did. They walked Jesus away and headed out to be crucified. Now, the interesting thing about all of this is, and kind of, I've talked so fast I'm going to have some time left for it, but kind of an interesting thing of this is that we know that Judas committed suicide for his betrayal. Pilate, shortly after all of this, was demoted. He lost his position as governor, and then shortly after that, committed suicide. And Annas, the original high priest, okay, after Jesus died, okay, the crowd turned on him, okay, and they stoned and killed him. Okay, so we have these three kind of bad guys, okay, that were punished by the mob that they were working. I find it kind of interesting through all of that. And in my studies, I wasn't aware of that. But I thought it was just, it kind of fit the picture. Pilate, in washing his hands, did not, okay, basically absolve himself from any guilt, and he knew it. Okay, because he is the one that turned it over. But he was between a rock and a hard place. But you know what? He lost anyway. Okay, he lost his governorship because the people, once they realized what they had done, they weren't happy and were creating problems for the Roman Empire. And with that, I'll just ask forgiveness for anything I might have said that was wrong. And I hope you learned something from it. It's a very, very interesting study to go through it. I had pages and pages and pages of notes. There's a lot of information, but you have to pretty much screen it down. Going through the six different trials of Jesus are scattered between the four Gospels, but each time, you know, he never got defensive. And I think that's, for me, that's an important lesson. Get accused of things, what's the first thing you want to do? You know, you want to defend yourself. And we have such an example, you know, from Jesus. He didn't. Even though he was right, even though he was not guilty of any of that, okay, he stood there and let them say what they wanted to say. And I think of all the times, you know, you get backed into a corner. What happens? You want to fight. And you're better off just following Jesus' footsteps. Because it pretty much ends there. All of those that tried Jesus were totally amazed and taken back by Jesus' behavior. They didn't know what to do. Okay, the argument was over. He just stood there, took it, and I don't know what to do with this guy. So what do? They passed him on to somebody else. Okay, and I think there's a big lesson in that. Thank you.